initiative that you would like to promote, CFRU can help you out. Free public service announcements are available to all not-for-profit events and organizations, while for-profits have the option to choose from an ad package that is competitively priced to give you the highest quality ad at the best deals available. A staff member will guide you through the entire process and ensure that you are pleased with the final result before it is put on air. If you are interested in having an ad or PSA run on our station, please contact outreach@cfru.ca for more information.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate. Small are the lies of cheats and of liars, of bigoted news press, fascist town crier. Deception annoys me, deception destroys me. The Bill of Rights throws me in jails, they all know me. Frustrated our churchmen, saving a soul man. The tinker, the tailor, the the colonial governor. They pull and they paw me. They're seeking to draw me away from the brownness of the light. Civil servants, they thrive off my body. Their trip is with power, back bacon and welfare. Police, they arrest me. Materialists test me. Pollution, it chokes me. Movies, they joke me. Politicians exploit me. City life jades me. Hudson, they fleece me. Hunting laws throw me. Government is bumbling. Revolution's rumbling. To be ruled in impunity is tradition continuity. I pity the country. I pity the state. And the mind of a man who thrives on hate.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Willie Dunn, Aboriginal Canadian artist, from the film The Other Side of the Ledger, about the abuses that the Hudson's Bay Company committed against Indigenous Canadians, which is from the National Film Board back in the 1970s. Now, here on Back in the USSR, of course, we're against colonialism. We're against settler colonialism, against imperialism, and we also stand against capitalism and understand how these things are intertwined in Canada. And this is, of course, June 30th, the day before Canada Day. Some people might not appreciate the things which I will have to say tonight. They will find it offensive. You know, they want to believe that their country is a good country, that it can do no wrong. And they want to feel secure in that. But ultimately, the truth must be told, for this is a settler colonial society. And the systemic injustice that this society perpetuates, which Willie Dunn sings about, that has to be exposed for what it is. That needs to be talked about, that needs to be engaged, and it needs to be defeated, it needs to be overthrown. That's ultimately what needs to happen. And, you know, it's important to understand how these things are connected. There was an event today I went to. There was a demonstration in downtown Guelph that was very well attended, I'm very happy to say. I haven't seen that kind of numbers of people showing up in front of City Hall since I went to the memorial for Colton Bushi earlier this year. And what this was about was to protest against the barbaric detention of migrant children by American authorities. But as a number of like indigenous activists who were there pointed out, this also happens in Canada. This is a crime of Canadian colonialism as well as American colonialism. This is a crime that happens in Canada. Detention of children happens in Canada. I talked a little bit about that last week. And I just want to mention again that you know, concentration camps for kids are not unique to the United States. You know, when this whole story about the separation of migrant children from their parents really blew up in the U.S. recently, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau gave his usual lukewarm, annoying criticism of the Donald Trump administration and said something, in fact, this is not the way we do things in Canada. He was lying. Not for the first time. He was lying, flat out. In recent years, Canada has detained hundreds of migrant children from the Middle East, West Africa, Central America, and the Caribbean. I mentioned this last week. I'll mention it again. In February 2017, the report, Invisible Citizens, Canadian Children in Immigration Detention, came out. It was a study produced by the International Human Rights Program at the University of Toronto's Faculty of Law. And it revealed that there were 48 kids being detained in the Toronto Immigration Holding Center alone at that time in 2017 when that report came out, including infants and toddlers, right? So we're not even talking like older kids here. We're talking like young kids, you know, babies even. And they're in detention in Canada. And that's still going on here. Like, once again, this here today in 2018, once again, that study only covered the detention center in Toronto. It didn't look at Lindsay. It didn't look at the many other detention facilities that exist across this country. So that isn't even a complete picture of what's going on. But it's going on here. And I'm glad that was at least mentioned today. I mean, a lot of people didn't really... It seemed that a lot of people at that who went to that rally, like, did not realize that. They didn't understand that. And they thought this was just an American phenomenon, like Canada has nothing to do with it. Well, Canada, of course, also has, believes, you know, continues to classify the United States as a safe country for refugees. They will not accept people who come from the United States to Canada seeking asylum, because the United States is considered a safe country, even though, you know, we know the kind of crimes they commit against migrants, the kind of atrocities they commit. You know, it's clear for all to see now. But they're still considered a safe country. So that needs to be pointed out. That needs to be understood. Another thing I also want to mention, because I've been covering this for the last several months, you know, and it's a very difficult thing to talk about. But Friday, June 29th, 2018, Israeli regime forces once again opened fire upon peaceful demonstrators in Gaza, killing two and injuring more than 420. The two killed were 13-year-old Yasser Abu Naja and Muhammad al-Hamadiya, who was 25 years old. And the 13-year-old child was executed by an Israeli sniper who targeted him with an explosive bullet. So, not indiscriminate violence, very targeted, very deliberate murder. And the head wound inflicted upon the child killed him instantly. And reporters from the Gaza's health ministry indicate that journalists and medics were among those injured. More than 420, of course, were injured, you know, including a man who was shot in the neck and remains in critical condition. So this is what's going on. This is, once again, the face of colonialism, imperialism in Palestine. And we understand what the face of colonialism is in North America as well and how brutal that is. So the connection needs to be made. Once again, all these states support each other. I mean, God knows Israel is considered a safe country as well. So all this stuff needs to be taken to task. You know, all this stuff needs to be dealt with. You cannot simply ignore this. You cannot simply go out on Canada Day, paint your face, go to like go to parties, go to fireworks displays, all this sort of stuff, and not recognize this kind of thing. This is the land we stand on. And it's stolen Indigenous land. Man, that's what we're going to talk about today. I have in the studio Brennan Campisi. Here again.
Hello.
I had him on earlier this month, I believe, when we talked before about the struggles of Indigenous people in this country for liberation against a settler colonial state, which was frankly crushing them and still is. And so I decided to bring him back on just, you know, here before Canada Day, like in a very timely show, talk about these things, talk about all the things that need to be addressed. Frankly, if you're going to be truthful about where this country actually stands right now. So thank you very much for coming on.
Always good to be here.
Mm-hmm. So I understand you wanted to start by saying a few words about a particular philosopher who deserves more credit than he usually gets and, you know, more of a profile than he usually gets. A late philosopher.
Yes.
Right. So if you want to maybe start with that.
Sure. Yeah. So the first thing just that I wanted to say this week was just to make note that we lost an exemplary revolutionary intellectual this week when Domenico Lucerto, the Italian communist philosopher and historian, died at the age of 77. And Lucerto had written a series of extremely important and relatively influential works including, but not limited to, liberalism, a counter history, which is sort of an exposure of the oppression, violence, and racism that are tied up in the entire Western liberal tradition, war and revolution, which is a critique of sort of the narrative of totalitarianism and the equation of communism and fascism, and sort of trying to connect fascism with its true historical roots in European colonialism. He wrote a critique of the sort of the black legend around Joseph Stalin. And he wrote I think his last sort of major work was sort of an exploration of the concept of the class struggle in Marx and Engels and Lenin, and sort of trying to apply it to the world today. And he also wrote many sort of essays on, you know, topics ranging from, you know, contemporary China to sort of the how we should evaluate sort of the general kind of fate of the communist movement in the 20th century. And, you know, Lacerda, through all of this work, made a number of important contributions. There was a number of sort of consistent emphases in his work. One was to, you know, to defend the historical record of the communist movement and to point out that, you know, all of its, you know, errors and shortcomings in the 20th century have to be understood in the context of, you know, the struggle against a global system of imperialism. And he also sort of placed the struggle of the colonized majority of humanity for liberation at the center of political struggle in the 20th century, and in, you know, in his sort of later political interventions around, you know, contemporary conditions, he had that same focus. He always, you know, he made a point of talking about Syria, the need, you know, the need to support the struggle of the Syrian people for independence and sovereignty, for example. And he always made a point of taking care to expose the sort of a self-flattering sort of mythology that liberal Western societies sort of create about themselves. And I think it's especially that last note that actually does tie into what we're going to talk about today, because God knows Canada is no stranger, Canadian society is no stranger to self-flattering mythology. And so there's definitely a lot of work to be done in terms of trying to, you know, trying to counter that and trying to deal with that. But yeah, I just wanted to say a few words about a really, really great, great communist that we lost this week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very, very significant. I wish more people knew about him, honestly.
And absolutely.
Now, we did talk, of course, about colonial violence. And of course, this is something Lizardo focused on quite a lot, like colonial violence and genocide.
Yeah.
These two concepts. And we talked about that to some degree last time you were on the show. But we didn't talk about, like, say, the reserve system or the Indian Act or the destruction of indigenous economies, really. Maybe we talked a little bit about that. But there was a lot of things that, and the residential school system and these matters, really, we didn't get a chance to really focus
right
on last time. So I think maybe we can start talk by focusing on that.
Sure, yeah. So I think this sort of carries on chronologically from what we talked about the last time that I was on, which was mostly focused on the 18th, or at least as far as colonialism, on the 18th and 19th centuries. And we sort of left off with, you know, the late 19th century defeat of the Mitzi resistance, which sort of paved the way for the establishment, at least in the West, of the reserve system as we've come to know it. And I sort of want to focus particularly on the economic aspects of the reserve system. Because I think there's something that happens a lot in especially sort of more mainstream and more liberal discussions of just the, you know, the oppression of indigenous people in Canada, which is that there's a sort of a focus on the category of culture in a way that's understood as being sort of abstracted from, you know, people's sort of day-to-day efforts to keep themselves alive. And there's this idea that, the cultural aspect of this is at the center. And we'll sort of break down that distinction in a little bit, because it really is an artificial distinction. So first off, certain sort of aspects of the economic effects of the reserve system. And I think this is really, really important to understand because, you know, one of the defining facts of Indigenous life in contemporary Canada is poverty. And, you know, Canadian society, mainstream Canadian society, has a number of different ways of explaining Indigenous poverty. And some of them are sort of, you know, there's, you know, sympathetic but sort of patronizing narratives about, you know, sort of portraying indigenous people as sort of the victims of various pathologies. And then, you know, and this is something that many, many, many white Canadians continue to believe, there's an explicitly racist narrative about indigenous poverty, which simply holds that, you know, it's the result of deficiencies of character and laziness and whatnot. So a look at the economic sort of aspects of the reserve system and the Indian Act system as they were implemented in the late 19th and earlier 20th centuries, well, into the mid-20th century, I guess most people talk about, is, I think, sort of the key to actually understanding the historical roots of indigenous poverty in Canada. So most of the examples that I'm going to use for this are going to come from one particular area, going to come from the area of Treaty 3 in northeastern Ontario. Treaty 3 in northwestern Ontario, near the border with Manitoba, because I happen to have sort of become familiar with some of that history in an academic context, and I've been able to find some, you know, some useful material around that. But these are examples that will sort of illustrate things that happened across the country. So one sort of extreme thing to start with, but I think sort of reveals a lot, is something that I think I referred to in passing the last time I was here, which is the peasant farming policy. So as is well known, one of the sort of the ideological rationales behind the establishment of the reserve system in the first place was to turn nomadic or semi-nomadic groups of indigenous people into settled farmers. Because they wanted to clear them off of the land, but also because there was this idea that indigenous people could be brought into settled agricultural civilization and assimilated. We'll talk more about assimilation later. But this was not implemented in any sort of straightforward way. And basically, because in the 1880s and 1890s, one of the leading sort of Indian affairs bureaucrats was a man named Hayter Reed, who believed very strongly in sort of the anthropological doctrines of the time, that there was this very strict hierarchy of stages of development that civilizations and societies had to pass through. He believed that, you know, Native people in Canada could not simply go from what he would have considered savagery in terms of hunting and gathering and nomadism to civilization and settled agriculture. They had to be led through all of these different stages. So what that meant was that for most of the 1890s, indigenous people living on reserves were not allowed to use the latest agricultural technology. They were being forced to farm, but they were not allowed to use the farming techniques that were most efficient at the time. They had to use the same level of technology as medieval European peasants. And there was a lot of resistance to this policy. Many Indian agents on the ground gave up on implementing it. And it demoralized a lot of indigenous farmers because it wasn't economically viable at all. And many scholars who've looked at this this policy have argued that besides sort of Hayter Reed's particular ideology, the other aspect of why this was being done was because they wanted indigenous people to be able to farm enough that they wouldn't starve to death, but never enough that they would be competitive on the market for agricultural products with white settler farmers. And so that sort of ties into the more broadly sort of the nature of the economic impacts of the Indian Act system in its early decades and the reserve system in its early decades, which is that from the 1880s onward, a series of regulations are put in place under the Indian Act on every aspect of indigenous economic life, whether that's hunting, fishing, farming, and there were immense restrictions on what kind of technology indigenous people could use, how they could market their products, whether they were able to, whether they were able to market them at all, or whether they were simply forced to stay at subsistence, where and when they were able to hunt and fish. Most of the numbered treaties, incidentally, guarantee hunting and fishing rights in various ways. But this is something that the Indian Affairs Department started to quickly restrict, from the 1880s onward. So you have the livelihoods of indigenous people being systematically undermined. And again, sort of the territory of Treaty 3 provides a really good example of this because before Treaty 3 was signed, Treaty 3 was signed in 1873, and in the earlier part of the 19th century, down to the 1860s, every, Euro-Canadian observer who traveled to the territory, which is the area around the Lake of the Woods, the largest, settlement there today is Kenora, said that, the Anishinaabe people living at the Lake of the Woods were so prosperous that, you know, they didn't need to be involved in the fur trade, right? The HBC could never establish a real relationship with these people because there was abundant fish in that area. There was abundant game. You could harvest so-called wild rice very effectively every year. And they were also engaged in a little bit of farming. And so when they signed Treaty 3, they drove a very hard bargain in the negotiations because they were economically independent. They couldn't be, you know, they couldn't be starved into an unacceptable deal like, you know, many nations in the Prairie West. And that continued for about a decade, the first decade of the reservation sort of era in that territory, because there were not actually white settlers entering into that part of what was about to become Northern Ontario at that time. But then from the later 1880s, people do start to do this. And so what you see across Northern and Western Canada as these new reserves are being established, and this is in some ways repeating processes that had taken place earlier, farther south and farther east, which we sort of talked about in that previous show. So what you see is, on the one hand, the increasing restriction of Indigenous livelihoods, whether that's things like the peasant farming policy or the basic fact that people living on reservations were dependent on the Indian agent for access to seed and any kind of agricultural equipment and credit, and they were dependent on the Indian agent to sell their products, or the fact that they were often restricted from fishing or hunting for commercial purposes at all and were only allowed to do it for subsistence. And you see all of these policies sort of being turned to the benefit of white settlers who are moving into you know, this broad swath of northern and western Canada and starting to exploit the resources. So at the same time as these restrictions are being put in place, for example, again, in the territory of Treaty 3, you have large numbers of settlers who now start fishing and, you know, you start capitalist fishing, you know, and overfishing starts going on in the waters of the Lake of the Woods. And you have extensive logging, you have, you know, trapping and hunting by white, you know, by white settlers. You have mining starts to happen on Indigenous land all across the country at this point. You have logging. You have all these sort of extractive processes. And Indigenous people can't get jobs in these new industries that are being built on their land because of racism. And so within, you know, within a few decades, in, again, this area where the Indigenous people, before they had, you know, signed this treaty with Canada, were economically independent and successful, within a few decades, between the fact that their farming had been hobbled by things like the peasant farming policy and the fact that they were now subject to provincial game laws, which was a violation of treaty rights, but they were. And there, you know, there have been court cases in the past few decades that have sort of confirmed the fact that, yes, provincial game laws were never supposed to be applied to Indigenous people. But for most of the 20th century in all of the most provinces of Canada, the provincial governments and, you know, the agencies responsible for that area routinely violated treaty rights and, you know, sent people to jail for hunting in their own land. So between that and the restrictions on fishing and the fact that the ecological effects of certain kinds of development of hydroelectricity and dams and logging had actually changed the character of the lakes and the rivers and made it impossible, at least probably by the 1950s, but maybe even earlier than that, to harvest wild rice in this area. It was becoming basically impossible to live. And Indigenous people at this point had no access to the sort of welfare, the very meager, you know, welfare and relief services that existed in mainstream Canadian society before the Second World War. And they couldn't really break into the wage economy, for example, except in sort of very insecure, very seasonal kind of ways, as, you know, very, very exploited labor at the lowest level of these extractive industries, or in the area around the Lake of the Woods, many Anishinaabe men worked as guides in the tourist industry. And many women sort of sold folk art, you know, to tourists and whatnot. But that wasn't really enough to live on. And many, you know, many people became sort of dependent as a last resort on their, you know, their backyard gardens. And there was an atmosphere of absolute, you know, desperation. And this is what, you know, in the 1960s, influenced by the civil rights movement, there was this sort of new wave of sort of white liberal Canadian attention to the conditions on reservations. And this is what they discovered, was people living in absolute misery because systematically over the preceding decades, a network of state policies had been put in place to essentially constrain the ability of indigenous communities to support themselves as a means of giving over those resources and the ability to access those resources and to, you know, to accumulate wealth off of them over to the settler society, and especially, of course, the capitalist class of the settler society. So that sort of, in a nutshell, is, you know, sort of the economic kind of side of the Indian Act system in its sort of its earliest and sort of most repressive period of operation. One other thing that I'll say about that is there was also a very, very concerted effort to break up the indigenous, the communal aspect of the indigenous economy. Government officials in late 19th century Canada and the United States referred to indigenous societies as communist. And they compared them to the revolutionary movement that was developing out of the working class and industrial society in Europe. And they said that, you know, private property was the basis of civilization, and that for native people to become civilized, the tribe or the commune had to be broken up, and native people had to come to see themselves as self-supporting, and, you know, the family as an independent economic unit out for itself in the world. And so there were systematic efforts both in Canada and the United States to divide up, especially in the 1880s and the 1890s, to divide up indigenous land into, you know, private property, which it had never been. It's totally alien, you know, to the traditions of any indigenous society in North America. It wasn't pursued as rigorously in Canada as, you know, the property forms on reservations on reserves in Canada today are still pretty anomalous, but they're not exactly, you know, capitalist private property. But the idea was also, and this was, again, very successful in the U.S., was also to make the land more available to settlers, because land that's no longer the property of the community but is now the individual property, you know, of one indigenous person or one indigenous family, can now be sold to white settlers freely. And, you know, obviously people living in poverty are more likely than not to, you know, to sell what they can, you know, for short-term benefit if they've been sort of, you know, encouraged to think in that way, in that sort of that individualist kind of way. So there was a concerted effort to do that, and that is still going on, right? There's extensive, you know, there's a lot of, you know, academic discourse about this, and there's every so often the Canadian state comes up with a new plan to break up property on reserves into individual private property, and that is, you know, I think very, very rightly seen as an attack on the economic and social sort of fabric of indigenous communities.
Well, yeah, clearly. I mean, and this goes into the whole the reality that there is no separation between culture and economy.
Yes. I mean,
these two things are very intertwined.
Yes.
And if you attack the economic foundation of indigenous people, of course you're going to attack their culture too. And of course, if you attack their culture, you're going to attack their economy most likely. And of course, this flows into what we're going to talk about residential schools.
Yes, absolutely.
And how these were used as a you know, active instrument of genocide against indigenous people in this country, which is like very, very serious, and still to this day does not get talked about enough.
Right.
So if you could speak to that.
Sure. Yeah. Just to expand, just first briefly to expand on the point about the relationship between culture and economy. Mostly this is something that that comes from a Dene political philosopher, Glenn Coulthard, in his excellent book, Red Skin, White Masks, where he points out that, you know, the concept, it's actually an attempt to sort of reinterpret the Marxist concept of the mode of production. And he sort of draws on a particular a set of references in Marx and Engels where the mode of production is taken to mean not simply, you know, people's economic relations, but their entire sort of mode of life. And he draws on the sort of the arguments that Dene people, you know, in his community in the Northwest Territories made in the 1970s when they were contesting the construction of an oil and gas pipeline down the Mackenzie Valley, and in which they talked about integrally a threat to to their way of life as Dene people that was simultaneously understood in terms of the actual economic processes of hunting and trapping that they depended on, and the entire complex of you know, values and beliefs and social relationships that were embedded in that. So Coulthard, I think, makes a very, very compelling argument that in these situations, you know, the cultural and the economic cannot be separated. And as you said, you know, an attack on the one is an attack on the other. The debates around the Mackenzie Valley pipeline, incidentally, are very, very similar to these, you know, to the struggles that are going on by, you know, indigenous communities, mostly, you know, in the West today, against oil pipelines. So, you know, there's a lot of history repeating itself and/or rhyming in these situations. But yes, so we'll continue to the you know, the point about about genocide, and this is, and the residential school system, and this is something that I think is extremely important to talk about, you know, at this time when, you know, as you mentioned, there's this sort of, tomorrow is this great public celebration of the national virtue of Canada, and this is sort of, this set of historical events is something that I think just blows a massive hole in that, and I don't think it's really possible to understand what happened, you know, in these places, and to really think that Canada is a good country, which is why, even though most people in Canada today have some idea of what happened in the residential school system, I think it's completely inadequate, because most Canadians continue to believe that we live in a good society. So, in a roundabout way, I think I'd like to start with the Canadian government's 2008 apology for the residential school system. So that was put out in the under the Harper government, and there's been a lot of criticism of that apology from, you know, indigenous activists and thinkers. And there's a few sort of salient points about that. One is that I wish I had the speech in front of me, but what I've been told by people who've analyzed it is that there's a lot of very abstract and very sort of passive language in it, and it sort of talks about a crime without a perpetrator. Things are described as having happened, but it's not really clear who is responsible for them, or sort of Canada in general is named as being responsible for them, which is true in a way, but can also be used to abstract away from the fact that a particular set of government agencies and a particular set of Christian churches and individual people, you know, ran the residential school system. And, you know, very, very, very few people have ever, individual, you know, people have ever been held accountable for crimes committed in the residential schools, much less sort of, no one has ever been held accountable for simply running the system itself. And there are, you know, there are former government officials and clerics who are alive today in this country who ran residential schools. You know, the last one closed in the 1990s, and, you know, the system was substantially sort of running down by the late 1960s, but it's not that long ago. And, you know, so the Canadian government's apology doesn't really hold anyone accountable when there are specific agencies and individuals who need to be held accountable. Another thing is that it situates this, you know, this crime in the past. And even more than some other sort of Canadian government apologies for crimes against Indigenous people, the residential school apology specifically takes that one particular set of events, and it totally erases any kind of context in a structure of settler colonialism, right? That the residential schools were in some way connected to the process of taking land from Indigenous people is just absolutely erased in the residential school apology. And this is something Coulthard actually points out, that, you know, it's the same Harper government that makes this residential school apology. And then Harper also said Canada has no history of colonialism. And this can seem like a contradiction until you look at how the apology actually functions. And the apology is from the standpoint of, you know, the Canadian elite saying that we don't have a colonial history. What we have is this one particular, you know, this one particular black spot that doesn't connect to any kind of larger system. And then the final sort of really, really important problem with the residential school apology and with a lot of public discourse around the residential schools and a lot of the public discourse of reconciliation that we've seen in this country in the past several years, and this also comes from Coulthard among others, is that it it presents indigenous people as the ones with the problem, right? That the problem is that these terrible things happened, and so now indigenous people have these social problems, these social pathologies, and that, you know, in order to solve this, what needs to happen is that, you know, indigenous subjects, you know, Coulthard, as the philosopher says, need to be repaired in some way, rather than the problem being with Canada and the problem with being with the oppressive social and political and economic structures of Canada needing to be, you know, altered and abolished. So there's no accountability, there's no history, and there's an absolutely backwards sense of where the problem and the responsibility for a solution to the effects of this historical crime lie. So that's sort of one of the most important, you know, kind of ideological reflections of this whole residential school, you know, question. And so I said that I don't think that what most Canadians know about them is adequate. And I think there's a couple of aspects of that. One is that, again, there's a heavy sort of focus on culture in the discussion of residential schools. People know that, for example, children in residential schools were beaten for speaking their own languages. And they know that they were basically forced to convert to Christianity, and they weren't allowed to practice their own religious and spiritual traditions. And those are, you know, sort of immaterial culture, right? Or material culture. Everybody also knows that they were given different dress and, you know, boys couldn't have long hair anymore and such. And those are important aspects of what happened in these places. The word schools does not really seem right to me to describe what they were. And I'll get to actually one of the reasons why that is in a second. But there's two aspects of the residential school system that I don't think people know enough about, which is, and one of them has to do with labor, and the other has to do with death. And this is, you know, this isn't even going to be easy for, you know, for me to talk about as, you know, somebody who's learned about all these things sort of third hand in a fairly distant way. I encourage everyone, you know, everyone listening, especially if you're a non-Indigenous Canadian, I encourage you to look into the oral histories that have been documented of the residential school system and people's experiences in it over the past, the past several decades. There's been a lot of that work done since the 1980s, and especially since about 2000. And so I encourage people to really sort of try to stare that history in the face as much as possible. So starting with labor. So until the 1950s, because there was a series of sort of revisions to the school system and many sort of aspects of the Indian Act system in response to sort of a wave of organizing by Indigenous veterans after the Second World War. So between the 1880s, 1870s, 1880s, when the residential school system was established, and the 1940s, most, you know, children who were placed in these, you know, in these so-called schools spent only half of their day in class. They spent the other half of the day working. And what they were being trained to do was, you know, super exploited menial labor, in particular gendered ways. So the boys were being trained essentially to be low-skilled farm workers, and the girls were being trained to be domestics. And so, we talked about last time about the sort of the decreasing value of Indigenous labor to Canadian capitalism over time since the decline of the fur trade and sort of the priority placed on taking Indigenous land. But of course, it doesn't go away. The super exploitation of Indigenous labor, especially in sort of like the economies of particular rural areas in Canada, does not disappear. And this is part of the focus of the residential school system, is sort of creating this this sub-proletariat out of the Indigenous people. And children in the residential schools were often hired out to, you know, nearby farmers and businesses, and they were forced to work. In some cases, they were forced to work for no pay at all. So we have something analogous to slavery taking place in Canada in the 1920s and 30s and 40s. And they were overworked and underfed, right? A few years ago, a researcher here at the University of Guelph, Ian Mosby, made headlines when he discovered that there were experiments that were done on the nature of nutrition that were conducted during the 1940s and 50s on children in residential schools. And there was a lot of misguided reporting on that that said that children in the residential schools were being starved in order to do experiments on them. But that's not what was happening. What was happening was that children in the residential schools, by default, were starving. And that situation was taken advantage of in order to conduct experiments on nutrition. It's absolutely abhorrent. But more than that experiment is abhorrent. The normal conditions were starvation. That's actually the single most common note in sort of oral histories and memories from the residential school system is not actually physical or sexual abuse. It's actually hunger. Because every single, you know, child in these places experienced hunger, right? Regardless of whatever else may or may not have happened to them, they were all essentially being starved. And they were also being overworked. And so as a combination of that and the fact that, and in the early decades, you know, you're coming out of a period of rampant epidemic disease in indigenous societies across the West as sort of part of the collapse of their traditional economies and the period of conquest as sort of accompanied by disease. Huge numbers of children died in the residential schools. Many of these places have mass graves on site. And especially in the early, in the early decades, it's estimated that up to half of children who were taken to these places, you know, never came out. And so we'll talk about cultural genocide in a second. But it's very important to recognize that these places where, as the cliche goes, the intent was to kill the Indian and save the child, on a very significant scale, something like up to a quarter or a third of children who were taken to these places over the entire history of the system, they didn't just kill the Indian. They killed the child as well. And that's just, I don't think that's something that's really filtered into the popular consciousness. So I did just want to, flag those particular aspects of the system. So then I guess, yeah, the last thing that I want to, to talk about with regard to that has to do with genocide in general. And, this is something that a woman who spoke at the Guelph Rally for Justice for Colton Bushi in January was very, very emphatic on, that we have to be willing to say that Canada is genocidal. And I think we have to be willing to say that, on Canada Day and wherever else. Because it's the truth. Genocide has to do with, or is, an attempt to eliminate, in whole or in part, a group of people. And that does not have to mean, rounding people up and shooting them. If you're trying to destroy sort of the cohesion and the fabric and the continuity of the existence, the self-conscious and sustained existence of a human community, then you're committing genocide. And it's a matter of obvious historical and current fact that Canada is guilty of this. The phrase cultural genocide is often used in the discussion of the oppression of Indigenous people in Canada. I think it sort of had a legitimate beginning in that Harold Cardinal, who was one of the great figures, one of the leaders of sort of the post-white paper period of Indigenous organizing in Canada, used the phrase. But since then, it's sort of been adopted by, in many cases, sort of very establishment voices. And there was an Australian scholar who died a couple of years ago, Patrick Wolfe, who wrote some very insightful work on settler colonialism and on genocide. And he made the point that cultural genocide, even if it should really just be sort of an adjective, is taken to sort of qualify the term genocide. And it's taken to suggest that there was a form of genocide that is not as bad as rounding people up and shooting them. That, physically killing people is sort of the standard for genocide, and that attacks on culture are in some way not quite as bad. And that is why I think the term cultural genocide is more digestible in mainstream Canadian discourse than genocide full stop. But as Wolf pointed out, if you attack people's culture, you do attack their ability to physically live. He pointed out that during the period, for example, during the period in the United States when the communal organization of the indigenous economy was being destroyed and the land was being broken up into private ownership, indigenous populations of the United States reached their lowest point. And he pointed out that, you know, Aboriginal people in Australia have a systematically lower life expectancy than white Australians. And indigenous people in Canada have a systematically lower life expectancy. So the conditions that are in part the result of the attack on indigenous culture and on indigenous ways of life have a very obvious and a very stark impact on people's ability to actually stay alive. So there's a number of different problems sort of with the term cultural genocide. And it's also very much sort of an illegitimate adaptation from the way that genocide was originally understood. And if you look at sort of the original discussions of the concept and the term in the 1940s, it's very, very obvious that what the people who framed these concepts in the first place had in mind included things that Canada has done. So I'm just going to talk about that very briefly. So genocide was actually coined as a term in the 1940s by a man named Raphael Lemkin. And one of the really striking aspects of his original definition is that he argued that there were two different phases to genocide. And the one involved the attack on sort of the cultural pattern, as he called it, of the oppressed group. And then the second phase was the imposition of the pattern of the dominant group. So he had in mind, for example, this, you know, this work is all being done during the Second World War, the attempt to assimilate Polish people in, you know, Nazi-occupied Poland into German culture. But it fits perfectly with the record of every settler colonial society and, you know, for our purposes right now, Canada. Because that is, as everybody, you know, acknowledges, that was the point of the residential school system, and that has been the point of a huge array of, you know, policy by the Canadian state and other Canadian institutions over the past 200 years, has been to impose all of the patterns in terms of language and culture and way of life and values and condition, you know, every kind of condition of existence of Euro-Canadian society on Indigenous people. And if that were to be done successfully, then genocide would have been committed successfully, because even if, you know, people who are descended from Indigenous people would still exist, the integrity and the cohesion of that that culture having been destroyed fits the definition of a group of people having been eliminated. Patrick Wolfe actually argued that assimilation was more efficient than, you know, massacres or segregation, because massacres tend to sort of disrupt the social order even within the settler society. And with, you know, segregation like reserves, eventually that runs up against the demand for land from within the settler society. And there's going to be a pressure to continue to take that land. And there's also going to be sort of continuing resentment from the, you know, the surviving and conquered native population. But that if assimilation could be carried out successfully, then it would be sort of much cleaner. He did point out immediately after, this is in a book that he wrote called Traces of History, which is about sort of structures of race in different places in the world and at different points in history. Of course, he pointed out that this has actually never been done successfully. And, you know, Native people have, you know, all over the world have survived these assimilatory efforts. I'll get back to that. Going back to, again, sort of the original framing of genocide in the 1940s, two of the measures specifically named in the original convention, you know, on the prevention of the crime of genocide from, you know, from the late 1940s, immediately out of the aftermath of the Holocaust, are, and I quote, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group and forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. So these are also things that Canada has done in a systematic way. Imposing measures to prevent, intended to prevent births within the group. So Canada has at certain times actually subjected Indigenous women to involuntary sterilization on a significant scale. So that's obviously intended to prevent births within Indigenous communities. But also, and on a much larger scale, between the 1870s and the 1980s, there was a provision in the Indian Act, Section 12.1b of the Indian Act, that a status Indian woman who married any man who was not a status Indian would lose her status. And then her children would not be able to have status. This is sometimes described as a status Indian woman who married a non-Indigenous man. But if she married a non-status man who happened to be, who was also Indigenous, the same thing would apply. And so this is preventing birth from within the group, because if you lose status, you lose the right to live within your reserve, to live on a reserve, and you lose any kind of sort of official recognition as being part of an Indigenous community. And often, again, often the physical ability to live within one. So then the, you know, any children that women in that situation might have no longer contribute to the social and the cultural continuity of an Indigenous community, an Indigenous nation. And there's also, of course, the residential school system itself involves, you know, taking, transferring children of one group to another. And there were many people who, having left the residential schools, you know, as, you know, teenagers or adolescents, never reintegrated into Indigenous society. They weren't really able to. And then there's also, of course, since the 1960s and continuing to this day, the systematic overrepresentation of Indigenous children in the child welfare system. This is, you know, there was a phase of this process that became known as the 60s scoop, in that it was sort of, it began in the 1960s when provincial child welfare services gained jurisdiction over Native people living on reserves, which they had previously not had, and sort of continued in particularly malignant ways into the 1980s, but this is all still going on. So that involved transferring Indigenous children to the dominant group in Canadian society because huge numbers of children were being apprehended according to, you know, Euro-Canadian standards of who could and could not, you know, properly raise their children, and, you know, totally in disregard of the social and economic conditions on reserves, and, you know, applying conditions like, for example, you know, it's a principle in social work, in this area of social work, that poverty itself is never a justification. Poverty by itself is not a justification for taking away children. But the way that this was applied to Indigenous people in mid-late 20th century Canada, poverty was enough. Because effectively it was poverty combined with, you know, combined with their race. So huge numbers of Indigenous people being apprehended, Indigenous children being apprehended, and then adopted out to white, or fostered out to white Canadian families, in some cases white families in the United States or even Europe. There were Indigenous children who were taken during the so-called 60s scoop who ended up in Ireland. And, you know, as, you know, transnational adoptees. And these children grew up, in many cases, without any connection to other Indigenous people. There was no way that they could form, you know, some any kind of, you know, self-identity as Indigenous people. And the sum of all of these processes, the residential, they were all going on at the same time. The residential school system, the sexist discriminatory provisions of the Indian Act that, you know, denied women, you know, women and children, you know, status in various ways, and, you know, child apprehension, creates this this sort of bleeding off, as a Mi'kmaq scholar, Benita Lawrence, who wrote about this, you know, bleeding off of Indigenous communities, and, you know, creates a situation where today, now, in Canadian society, huge numbers of people are sort of discovering an Indigenous family history that they have that was at one point or another severed, you know, severed very violently by all of these processes. And there were situations where, for example, and this was not uncommon, where, you know, an Indigenous child would be taken, and then on their, you know, on their files, their parents' identity would be falsified. You know, parents would be falsely described as, often it was French, or, you know, they were falsely described as a European, you know, European ethnicity, or, you know, First Nations people were falsely described as Métis, or anything to sort of, to create, to destroy kind of the paper trail of that child's Indigenous identity. So that if they ever learned about, or if they ever, you know, if they learned that they were, or they knew that they were adopted, they wouldn't actually be able to trace back to, you know, who their parents truly were. And there's no way to see that as anything other than a deliberately racist and deliberately genocidal measure to ensure that children that were being physically taken away from indigenous communities were being, you know, socially separated from, you know, indigenous community and identity as well.